Why are you frightened by an unembodied voice? Your sister will not harm you, just perhaps her future boys. You have my word, dear brother. When your sister bears our sons, I promise to bring each to you to do what must be done. Although he was atrocious, when he heard these gentle words, cruel Kongsa put his sword away, completely reassured. He fully trusted Vasudev, whose character was such that Kongsa knew he'd keep his word, although he'd pledged so much. When Devaki was freed by Kongsa, in due time she bore a shining baby boy whom any parent would adore. Her husband took the boy away, for though he loved his son, he would not lie to Kongsa, nor indeed to anyone. What pain is there for saintly souls devoted to the truth? What evil is off limits for the low and the uncouth? And what cannot be given up in service to the Lord by those who want to please him and desire nothing more? When Kongsa saw that Vasudev had brought the newborn child exactly as he promised, he examined him and smiled. "Take back your son, dear Vasudev," said Kongsa with good cheer. "The omen said your eighth child is the one that I must fear." Returning with his baby boy, wise Vasudev perceived that Kongsa was impulsive and could never be believed. Now, at that time, Saint Narada, the ever-roaming sage, decided to speed Krishna's birth by prompting Kongsa's rage. Said Narada to Kongsa, "Sir, have you been made aware the gods are here as Yadus and surround you everywhere? Their presence in your neighborhood should lead you to assess that Vishnu will be coming soon to ease the earth's distress." The words of Narada left Kongsa thoroughly provoked and made him tremble angrily. Again the mystic spoke, "In your last life you also practiced wickedness and sin. Lord Vishnu killed you then, and now it seems he will again." As Narada departed, Kongsa fumed and set his mind. "Just see," he thought, "what happens when a man tries to be kind." He killed Devaki's baby and, along with Ugrasen, put her and Vasudev in jail and hailed his new domain. Now Vasudev and Devaki could see their only hope would come as the eighth child foretold in Kongsa's horoscope. Thus, suffering in prison after Kongsa killed their boy, each year they bore another child for Kongsa to destroy. What crime is too outrageous for a person who intends to please his flesh while caring less for family or friends? He'll even kill to have a thrill or fill a selfish whim. King Kongsa ruled with terror, and the people bowed to him. Devaki's eighth pregnancy. As Kongsa gathered power, he was nearly unopposed, for many other demons helped him terrorize his foes. He killed six sons of Devaki. The Yadus fled in fear, except for some who stayed and prayed for Krishna to appear. Her seventh pregnancy brought Devaki both joy and gloom. She didn't know the Lord's expansion lived within her womb. Lord Krishna, elsewhere, summoned Yogamaya to request that she protect his devotees through these clandestine steps. "My brother Balaram waits in the womb of Devaki, but he will leave as soon as it has been prepared for me. Take Balaram to Rohini, co-wife of Devaki. King Nanda guards her during Vasudev's captivity. King Nanda rules Gokula, that enchanting rural land. Now enter Yashoda, his wife, and execute this plan. Reside within Queen Yashoda throughout her pregnancy. When Balaram has left, I'll fill the womb of Devaki. First Balaram will take his birth and be Rohini's son. His charm and strength shall be unmatched, delighting everyone. When Yashoda delivers you, then I shall join the act, the eighth-born son of Devaki, my opulence intact. O Yogamaya, go now and accomplish all these tasks. I bless you to bewilder all and finish what I've asked. Henceforward, using sacrifice and all that it requires, some people will entreat you to fulfill their sense desires. Obediently, Yogamaya bowed before the Lord and left for Sri Gokula. Soon, exactly in accord with Krishna's order, Balaram departed Devaki and entered his new home within the womb of Rohini. When Devaki miscarried Balaram, the people said, "Since Kamsa kills her children, she aborted it instead." At that time, Krishna, God himself, who vanquishes all fear, went in the mind of Vasudev and ready to appear. While bearing Krishna, Vasudev appeared just like the sun, his glow so bright, the shining light astonished everyone. When he placed Krishna in the mind of Devaki one day, her visage bloomed, a waxing moon in opulent display. To bear the Lord while trapped in jail by Kamsa's wicked plot made Devaki seem like a fire kept within a pot, or like a man enlightened, wise, and thoroughly refined who fails to share his wisdom for the good of humankind. As Devaki grew jubilant, King Kamsa grew concerned. "This Vishnu killed me once," he thought, "and now he has returned to kill me once again. Yet killing Devaki today would only bring me trouble in a different sort of way. To kill a pregnant relative would cost me all respect. My opulence would vanish, and my subjects would defect. My health and life and legacy would all die out as well. A wicked man is just a corpse descending into hell." Deliberating in this way, King Kamsa chose to wait to let the child be born and then administer its fate. While on his throne or in his bed, King Kamsa stayed absorbed in thoughts about his enemy, the all-pervading Lord. The birth of Lord Krishna. One pleasant evening, earth seemed bathed in happiness and love. The sacred constellation Rohini appeared above with other stars and planets twinkling in the cloudless sky. The universe itself seemed pleasing, still, and satisfied. The moonlit Mother Earth displayed her pastures, mines, and towns. In fragrant trees, the birds and bees sang out their pleasing sounds. The rivers poured clear water into reservoirs and lakes where lotuses and lilies bloomed, appearing wide awake. The Brahmins rose before the dawn, took bath, and set alight their sacrificial fires in accord with Vedic rites. Across the lakes and pastures, silky, fragrant breezes came that they pleased the Brahmins tending fires, but didn't spoil the flames. The Brahmins, who had suffered much from Kamsa and his men, began to feel tranquility pervade their hearts again. The higher worlds resounded with the sounds of kettle drums as gods peered down at earth, expecting Krishna soon would come. While gods threw flowers, danced and sang in heavenly enclaves, assembling clouds made thundering sounds like gentle ocean waves. Then Vishnu, he who dwells within the hearts of you and me, appeared as if a full moon from the heart of Devaki. In his four hands the child held lotus, chakra, conch, and club. His bangled arms and jeweled ears and helmet placed above his scattered hair set off his yellow silks and blue-black skin. And there around his neck was hung the famed Kaustubha gem. As Vasudev beheld the child, he thought his eyes had failed. How could the Lord, so nicely dressed, be born inside a jail? The father could not celebrate, though he was much inclined, so he gave out 10,000 cows within his joyous mind. So here there's a conversation between Krishna and his parents in which the Lord informs them he was formerly their child in two previous lifetimes. And then Devaki very humbly asks him, "Please change your form because no one will believe I could have a four-armed child." And she was afraid of attracting attention. Lord Vishnu then fell silent, and before his parents' eyes, his figure changed from Vishnu to a child of normal size. Reclining in his legendary transcendental form, he showed himself as baby Krishna, smiling, bright, and warm. Then Yogamaya took her birth, just as Lord Krishna planned, across the river Jamuna in Nanda's rural land. When Yashoda, King Nanda's wife, gave birth that mystic night, Exhausted from her labor, she slept on, her eyes shut tight. By Yogamaya's influence, the guards in Kongsa's jail, not hearing sounds of childbirth, not a whimper, sob, or wail, fell fast asleep as well and could not see or hear a sound. At this, the gate swung open and their locks fell to the ground. When thundering clouds let out their rain as gently as they could, a mystic serpent sheltered man and son with many hoods. As Vasudev, the huge white snake and babe of blackish blue, snuck quickly past the sleeping guards, King Kongsa slept on too. The swirling river Jamuna, made deeper by the showers, came to a halt and made a path by Yogamaya's powers. The river welcomed Vasudev, lest Krishna should be lost, just as the Indian Ocean once allowed Lord Ram to cross. When Vasudev reached Nanda's house, where everybody slept, he found the room of Yashoda and pondered his next step. In hopes that even Kongsa would not kill a newborn daughter, he switched the babes and ran at once back through the swirling waters. Back past the sleeping guards he slipped, through every open door. He chained himself and Devaki in shackles as before. He placed the girl by Devaki, who looked at her and smiled, while Yashoda, asleep, knew not the gender of her child. Shri Krishna Janmastami ki jai. Thank you. So, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Now we'll hear commentary by Tomohar Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. I'd like to thank Kalakanta Prabhu very much for that wonderful rendition of the pastimes of Lord Krishna, and particularly his appearance day, which we are celebrating today. We're now going to read from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 2, Text 39. This is from the prayers by the demigods, which you skipped over, I believe, because they're quite long. Yes. Okay. Okay, so this is text 39. I'll just read through it. Tete bhavashyesha bhavashikaranam vina vinodham bhattatarakya mahe bhavonarodha sithirapya vidyaya kritayitas twaya bhayashrayatmane. O Supreme Lord, you are not an ordinary living entity appearing in this material world as a result of fruitive activities. Therefore, your appearance or birth in this world has no other cause than your pleasure potency. Similarly, the living entities who are part of you have no cause for miseries like birth, death, and old age, except when these living entities are conducted by your external energy. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita 15.7, Mamai Vangsho Jivaloke Jivabhuta Sanatana, the living entities are part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, and thus they are qualitatively one with the Lord. We can understand that when the Supreme Lord appears or disappears as an incarnation, there is no other cause than his pleasure potency. We cannot force the Supreme Personality of Godhead to appear. He says in the Bhagavad Gita, Yada yadahi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutanam dharmasya tadatmanam shujamyaham. Whenever and wherever there is a decline in religious practice, so descended to Bharata, and a predominant rise of irreligion, at that time I descend myself. When there is a need to diminish a burden created by the demons, the Supreme Godhead can do it in many ways because he has multifarious energies. There is no need for him to come as an incarnation, since he is not forced to do anything like ordinary living entities. The living entities come into this material world in the spirit of enjoyment, but because they want to enjoy without Krishna, they suffer birth, death, old age, and disease under the control of the illusory energy. When the Supreme Personality of Godhead appears, however, no such causes are involved. His descent is an act of his pleasure potency. We should always remember this distinction between the Lord and the ordinary living entity, and not uselessly argue that the Lord cannot come. There are philosophers who do not believe in the Lord's incarnation, and who ask, why should the Supreme Lord come? But the answer is, why should he not come? Why should he be controlled by the desire of the living entity? The Lord is free to do whatever he likes. Therefore, in this verse says, Vina vinodham bhattitarakaya mahe. It is only for his pleasure that he comes, although he does not need to come. When the living entities come to this world for material enjoyment, they are tangled in karma and karmapala by the Lord's illusory energy. But if one seeks shelter at the Lord's lotus feet, one is again situated in his original, liberated stage. It is stated here, Kata yitas tvai yavayashra yatmani. One who seeks shelter at the lotus feet of the Lord is always fearless. Because we are dependent on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we should give up the idea that without Krishna we can enjoy freedom in the material world. This idea is the reason we have become entangled. Now it is our duty to take shelter again at the Lord's lotus feet. The shelter is described as abhaya, or fearless. Since Krishna is not subject to birth, death, old age, or disease, and since we are part and parcel of Krishna, we are also not subject to birth, death, old age, and disease. But we have become subject to these illusory problems because of our forgetfulness of Krishna and our positions as his eternal servants. Jivera Sarupaya Krishnera Nichidas. Therefore, if we practice devotional service by always thinking of the Lord and always glorifying him and always chanting about him, we will be reinstated in our original constitutional position and thus be saved. The demigods therefore encourage Devaki not to fear Kamsa, but to think of the Supreme Personality of Godhead who was already within her womb. Om Gyana Timurandisha Gyananjana Salakaya Chaksurumitamina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Panchakopa Tribhishta Kripasindhu Bhavicha Patitano Pavane Bhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. So in this verse, we have a description of Krishna's appearance and some of the reasons for Krishna's appearance, and it's contrasting with the appearance of the living entity in this material world. So this indicates how Krishna's appearance can liberate the individual jiva soul from suffering. So there's a very strong connection between the appearance of Lord Krishna and the fate of the living entity. So we often glorify Krishna on his appearance day for so many wonderful qualities, but one of the most important qualities we should always remember is his great mercy on us and how his appearance has led to our liberation from this material entanglement. So as we know, setting the scene for this particular verse, that Krishna was the eighth child who had appeared to Devaki, first in the heart of Vasudeva, then transferred to the heart of Devaki. And of course, Devaki was effulgent, as we heard. What was the expression, like a, was it a fire in a pot? Like that? So because she had this great effulgence and, you know, just the illumination from her was apparent, the demigods all came. They understood that Krishna was now within Devaki and would soon appear. So they offer this whole second chapter is all the prayers by the demigods glorifying Krishna. And in this particular verse, it's stated how Krishna comes, his appearance is by his own sweet will. It is by his pleasure potence only that Krishna comes and appears in this world, and he is never forced to by material nature or the modes of nature or any external cause in contrast to the living entities. So earlier in the first chapter, in verse 7, the words Maya Manushasya are mentioned. That Krishna appears as an ordinary human being. He comes in the form of a human, and he performs activities that looks very much like an ordinary living entity. But of course, this is part of his illusion. He is covered for those who cannot understand. It's actually described, Prabhupada once said that when Krishna appeared on this earth, and so many, many people and relatives and friends and enemies, you know, so many people, only a few people actually understood that Krishna was God. Just a handful of people perhaps actually understood the position of Krishna. So he is not so easy to understand because he does appear as an ordinary human being. But yet, as we're hearing here, he is not an ordinary human being, and he never comes according to the dictation of the modes of nature. Rather, he is the complete independent. Right from the very first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam, he is called Swarat, one who is completely independent. So that is established right at the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, that Krishna is independent and free to do whatever he chooses. Whatever goes on is by his sweet will, but at the same time, there is obviously plan and purpose to everything that Krishna does. That's one of those sort of wonderful contradictions, that everything is very planned, but yet everything is independent. In other words, everything is very precise. Krishna has an exact way that he does things. He sets things up, you know, millennia in advance. Everything is scheduled, but yet it's completely due to his own free will. Because he's made the schedule, he's made the plan, it's his plan. So he's completely independent in that. And his appearance is very rare. It's described that Krishna only comes as Krishna in this particular form of Shyamasundara once in a day of Brahma. So there's a very precise time when he comes, during the seventh Manu, which is the Vaivishvatu Manu in our particular case. There's 14 Manus within a day of Brahma, so there's 74 Yuga cycles. There's 1,000 Yuga cycles within each day. So in exactly on the 28th Yuga cycle of the seventh Manu, during the Dwapara Yuga, Krishna appears. And coincidentally, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also appears, but that's for another day. But anyway, we have this wonderful occurrence. It's actually about once every 4 billion years that Krishna appears within this material universe. And that was only 5,000 years ago. So from the historical perspective, you know, it's just a flash. It's just a second in eternity. Krishna was with us. You know, and we actually, there's even actually historical, you know, evidence and things where Krishna actually was. You go to Vrindavan and these places are there. So this is a very, very wonderful occurrence, you know, that we need to completely appreciate this very, very rare of Krishna appearing on this earth planet just 5,000 years ago. So why does Krishna come, and what is his purpose? He reveals this, of course, in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. He says, Ajopi san ayatma bhutanam ishvaropi san prakritim svam adishtaya sambhavam yatma mayaya. Although I am unborn and my transcendental body never deteriorates, and although I am the Lord of all living entities, I still appear in every millennium in my original transcendental form. So it's confirmed, of course, in the Bhagavad Gita, that once in every millennium, or day of Brahma, that Krishna comes in this original spiritual form. And this is a very, very unique and special appearance. It is different than all other incarnations. It is different than any other appearances, any other energy, any other form, any other manifestation, because Krishna is appearing as his original personality. This is, of course, stated in the third chapter of the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is a very famous verse, which is called the Paribhashya Sutra. In other words, this is the sort of the culminating verse that everything else in the Bhagavatam expands upon when it's declared, Ete cham sakala pungsam krishnas tu bhagavan swayam intrari vyakalam lokam vidyanti yuge yuge. All of the above mentioned incarnations are either plenary portions or portions of the plenary portions of the Lord, but Lord Sri Krishna is the original personality of Godhead. All of them appear on planets whenever there is a disturbance created by the atheists. The Lord incarnates to protect the theists. 1328. So there it is confirmed, Krishna's two Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna is that original, supreme personality of Godhead, from whom all other incarnations and expansions are coming. So again, this very, very special situation. It's very, very, you know, this is why we worship Krishna. People say, well, why do you worship Krishna? Krishna, you know, God has many forms, God has many names. Yes, that's all true. You can worship God in many different ways, in many different forms. But we understand from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna's tu Bhagavan Swayam, that original Supreme Person is this spiritual transcendental form of Krishna. And Krishna comes for specific purposes, mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. Yada yada yadharmasya klanir bhavati bharata bhutanam dharmasya tatmana shajamyaham. Whenever and wherever there is a decline in religious practice, so descend to Bharata, and a predominant rise of irreligion, at that time I descend myself. So he comes to establish religious principles for the benefit of the living entities in this material world. And then he mentions three specific reasons that he comes. Pritranaya sadunam vinashaya chidushkatam dharmasam sarpanartayo sambhavami yuge yuge. To deliver the pious and to annihilate the miscreants, as well as to establish the principles of religion, I myself appear millennium after millennium. So we can see in Krishna's appearances in different incarnations, these purposes are fulfilled, and we can see it very specifically in the appearance of Lord Krishna. That Krishna comes to, obviously, to annihilate the miscreants. He is here. He will soon be killing Kamsa. In fact, we had a very nice recitation by Mother Nanda yesterday of Krishna entering Mathura and going to the wrestling gate, although she stopped just short of telling the pastime of actually killing Kamsa, which I was looking forward to. But anyway, we got the general story there. And, of course, many, many other demons were killed. The burden of the earth was relieved that Bhumi and the demigods had prayed for. So he accomplished that purpose. He reestablished religious principles. He spoke the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, completely reestablishing this disciplic succession of Bhagavad Gita, which he said was lost over the course of time. And so in so many ways, he performed these activities. But most importantly, he came to deliver the devotees, Pritranaya Sadhunam. This is really why Krishna appears on this earth, for the pleasure of his devotees, to deliver his devotees and to give pleasure and happiness to his devotees and engage in loving relationship with his devotees. This is a purport from that verse of Bhagavad Gita 4.8, where Srila Prabhupada explains this principle very nicely. Prabhupada says, as far as the atheists are concerned, it is not necessary for the Supreme Lord to appear as he is to destroy them, as he did with the demons, Ravana and Kamsa. The Lord has many agents who are quite competent to vanquish the demons. But the Lord especially descends to appease his unalloyed devotees, who are always harassed by the demoniac. Although Devaki, the mother of Krishna, was the sister of Kamsa, she and her husband Vasudeva were persecuted only because Krishna was to be born of them. So Lord Krishna appeared primarily to deliver Devaki rather than to kill Kamsa. But both were performed simultaneously. Therefore, it is said that to deliver the devotee and to vanquish the demon miscreants, the Lord appears in different incarnations. So as Prabhupada is saying here, Krishna can easily take care of the demoniac forces. Even material nature takes care of so many of the materialistic or demoniac personalities. Krishna can do this very indirectly just through his external energy. But even when Krishna comes to kill the demons, there's, I think it's in Adi 4, when purport Srila Prabhupada explains that it's actually Vishnu that kills the demons, that it's actually the Narayana or Vishnu form that is killing the demons. Krishna, in his form of Shyamasundar, actually does not kill the demons directly, but he does it through Vishnu or Narayana. So it's not necessary for him to do that, because Krishna's purpose is quite different. Krishna's purpose is to deliver his devotees. And as Prabhupada said so nicely in this purport, it wasn't really to kill Kamsa that Krishna came, but to give pleasure to Devaki and Vasudeva and to deliver them from the distressed condition that they were put in by Kamsa. But, of course, all purposes are simultaneously accomplished. This is the wonderful thing about Krishna. And sometimes when you read some of the purports and by the different acharyas and about the Srimad Bhagavatam, you see that so many things are happening. There are so many purposes served. Because, of course, Krishna is the most intelligent. He is far more intelligent than any other living entity. He is the creator of all of our intelligence collectively. And so he can plan so many things, and so many things can be worked out. And he uses his different potencies, like Yoga Maya, to make so many different arrangements. Just like he had Yoga Maya make the arrangement, right, to transfer Yoga Maya and Balaram from the wombs of Rohini and Devaki. So he can plan so many things out, and so many different purposes were there. Even earlier in the class, we were reading the 10th canto, first chapter in our regular Bhagavatam, which was kind of nice. It was bringing us up to the appearance of Lord Krishna just at this time. And it was explained there in some of the verses how even the killing of the six sons, this was all part of a very elaborate arrangement for the sons of Marichi, the Maruts, and, you know, it was a very elaborate pastime. So there are very, very many layers and levels of so many things that Krishna does. So all of these things are being accomplished. But at the same time, the primary purpose is for him to engage in his loving relationships with his devotees. So it's been mentioned here in this purport how Krishna comes and engages his devotees, attracts the minds of living entities away from our attraction for materialism that we're currently caught in. And some of the ways that Krishna attracts us is just by his very presence, by his very qualities and personalities. I very much enjoyed the last 3 days in our Bhagavatam classes. We analyzed, I hope a lot of you heard that, we analyzed the different opulences of Krishna. We had two each day. So we heard about, you know, Krishna's qualities of strength, wealth, beauty, fame, knowledge, and renunciation. And Krishna is supreme in all of these things. Nobody is equal to him. Just as sort of a recap on those 3 days of elaborating all of these wonderful qualities of Krishna, Srila Prabhupada says in a purport in Bhagavad Gita 2.2, he says that this is, I think, when Bhagavan is first mentioned. And so Prabhupada explains this word Bhagavan. Bhagavan, of course, means one who is full in all opulences. And Krishna is referred to many, many times throughout the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam as Bhagavan. So Prabhupada says, the Sanskrit word Bhagavan is explained by the great authority Parashara Muni, the father of Vyasadeva. The Supreme Personality who possesses all riches, all strength, all fame, all beauty, all knowledge, and all renunciation is called Bhagavan. There are many persons who are very rich, very powerful, very beautiful, very famous, very learned, and very much detached. But no one can claim that he possesses all riches, all strength, etc., entirely. Only Krishna can claim this because he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. No living entity, including Brahma or Lord Shiva or Narayan, can possess opulences as fully as Krishna. Therefore, it is concluded in the Brahma Samhita by Lord Brahma himself that Lord Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. No one is equal to or above him. He is the primeval Lord or Bhagavan, known as Govinda, and he is the supreme cause of all causes. So again, we have so many different scriptural references and so many different authorities are all proclaiming the same thing, that nobody can equal, no one can excel Krishna in all things, in all opulences, in all qualities, in all abilities. This is what it means to be God. Otherwise, how is Krishna God? If he is not the supreme, if he is not the original, if he is not the greatest, if he is not the source of all good qualities. And Krishna says, know that all beautiful, mighty, opulent things, everything is but a spark of my splendor. Everything is coming from him. He is the source of everything that we see and appreciate in the material world, which we know is only 1/4 of his energy. We barely even can understand 3/4 of his entire energies, which is the spiritual world that he manifests as well. So, as I was saying, Krishna appears by his own pleasure, and he appears for the pleasure of devotees, and he engages in loving pastimes with the devotees. So part of the reason that Krishna appears in Vrindavan and performs his many, many pastimes with not only in Mathura with Devaki and Vasudeva, but of course later with his parents Yashoda and Nanda, with the coward boys, with the coward girls, the gopis, with all the residents of Vrindavan, with the cows, with the trees, with the, everything. Every living entity which is totally conscious in, of course, the spiritual world, he performs these wonderful activities. And these activities are the most wonderful activities, which are meant to attract the minds and hearts of all of us. He could stay in the spiritual world and perform his activities just fine. He has his most wonderful devotees. All of his personal associates, his eternal associates, are with him eternally in Goloka Vrindavan. Why bother to come here? Why come to this earth planet to perform pastimes when he has his greatest devotees with him eternally? He comes for us. He performs these pastimes and he attracts the mind of the conditioned souls and gives pleasure to all of his devotees. So when Krishna comes to Vrindavan, he performs the most wonderful activities. This was mentioned by Nanda in the class yesterday, but I'll just, for those who weren't here, I'll just repeat it, that Krishna has, of course, 64 qualities, which are mentioned in the Nectar Devotion, the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And of those qualities, in some degree, that there are also 50 of those qualities are shared in small quantities by the living entity. Living entities who are very purified or who have very good qualities. Another 5 are shared by Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. And another 5 are found only in Narayan or Vishnu. But that leaves 4 qualities that Krishna alone possesses that are not found in any other being, any other expansion, incarnation, demigod, or living entity. And those are 1, that he's the performer of wonderful pastimes, especially his childhood pastimes. Now, I was thinking about other incarnations of Krishna, and you don't see so many. Ramachandra had a few childhood pastimes, but most of his pastimes is when he's older, right? When he reaches adulthood, you know, when he's really performing the really interesting things that he's doing, you know, and fighting demons, etc., like that. And but Krishna's pastimes are, you know, the first 40 chapters in Vrindavan of the Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, are all by the time he's 11 years old. You know, he has these wonderful, incredible childhood pastimes, and he totally delights the inhabitants of Vrindavan. Not only his parents, but everyone, all of the gopas and gopis, all of the residents of Vrindavan are totally enraptured, captured by his beautiful childhood pastimes and personality. You know, so this is very unique. The second one is he's surrounded by devotees endowed with wonderful love of Godhead. The devotees of Krishna are recognized in our scriptures, and particularly, of course, the Vaishnava scriptures, as the greatest devotees of the Lord. There's so many wonderful devotees, there's so many different bhaktas of different incarnations, but it's fairly much agreed upon, at least by the Vaishnavas, that those devotees of Krishna who are involved in the Vrindavan Leela are the most advanced devotees. They are the most special devotees. And, you know, there's many descriptions of this, you know, that that of all the devotees, you know, it becomes a little bit more sweeter and sweeter. You know, the pastimes in Dwarka are very sweet, and the pastimes in Mathura are even sweeter. And the sweetest of all are the Vrindavan pastimes. And we can see that, you know, the quality of the devotees is so special because they are 100% totally in love with Krishna. Their whole life is Krishna. They could hardly exist without him. When Krishna left for Mathura, when Akura took him on the chariot, we were hearing a little bit about that, but part we didn't hear yesterday was what the effect of that was on the residents of Vrindavan. They practically gave up their lives. They were in such distress, such anxiety upon the thought of losing Krishna for even a moment, what to speak of some time that he might be away. And they never realized that he'd be away for years and years and years and would only return, once or twice, you know. So the great distress, just at, you know, separation from Krishna, is unparalleled by any other devotees. Of course, these things are difficult for us to understand. They are very, very advanced. These are the most highest levels of spiritual ecstasy. But yet, when you hear the descriptions, we can understand their very great specialness and uniqueness, and how these devotees, especially, of course, culminating in the mood of the gopis, are the most advanced, most dedicated devotees that there are. So this is one of the unique features of Krishna, that he engenders this type of complete 100% selfless love amongst his devotees. He also can attract all living entities all over the universe by playing on his flute. No other incarnation plays the flute like Krishna. So Krishna has this very, very unique flute. We can only hope and pray that someday we may hear that flute, you know, in some advanced stage or future lifetime. You know, what we can only imagine, you know, the incredible beauty that just attracts everyone. It's described that even attracts, even the stones melt. I mean, it attracts living and non-living, you know, all entities are attracted by it, moving and non-moving. And fourthly, he has an excellence of beauty which cannot be rivaled anywhere in creation. So as we said, Krishna is the source of everything. He is the source of all opulences. One of those opulences is beauty. And the beauty of Krishna is certainly unparalleled. And fortunately, that's one of the opulences that we have an opportunity to get a little bit of glimpse at, because we're able to see the most beautiful form of Radha Shyamasundar and Krishna Balaram here on a daily basis. So we can actually begin to enter into just a little bit, a tiny understanding of this incredible beauty that Krishna exemplifies. So these are, of course, the wonderful, attractive qualities of Krishna that attract all of his devotees to him. And when he performs these wonderful pastimes in Vrindavan, then everyone becomes enlivened. Everyone wants to hear them over and over again. Someone was mentioning how in the old days we used to read Krishna book every night, you know, as the old, you know, hot milk and reading Krishna book. And even now, I mean, we can read these pastimes, you know, the pastimes we heard this morning. Anyone ever hear that before, the pastime of Krishna's birth? And like, you know, every Janmashtami for sure, if not every other. But yet we never tire of them. The pastimes of Krishna are exciting, and they're so attractive. You ever get tired of hearing or seeing a play of Nrisimhadev or, you know, any of these wonderful pastimes that Krishna performs? They never became dry or hackneyed or stereotyped, as Prabhupada would say. But they are always fresh. They always enliven us. And the more that we hear them, the more that we enter into them, then the more enjoyable they become and the fresher they become. So we have this opportunity to hear these wonderful pastimes because Krishna appeared on this earth 5,000 years ago. So, of course, Krishna is unique amongst all manifestations, incarnations, and these special qualities enhance these loving relationships with the devotees. So the purport goes a little bit further philosophically and describes the entanglement of the living entity in this material world. It talks about how we are entangled in this process of karma and karma palam. Karma pala simply means the results or reactions. Karma is action and pala is result or reaction. So many activities were involved in this material world, and there are so many reactions. And that cycle goes on and on, birth after birth, as we transmigrate from one body to another. And we simply, because of this going from one reaction to the next reaction, one body to the next body, the living entities are simply suffering in this material world. And that suffering that we experience is primarily due to our forgetfulness of our relationship with Krishna. So that's what Srila Prabhupada was so nicely explaining in this purport, that, you know, we are subject to birth, death, and old age and disease, but Krishna is never subject to these things. Krishna is always independent and free from them. But if we practice the process of hearing and chanting and remembering Krishna, then we also become free from birth, death, disease, and old age. Prabhupada says, therefore, if we practice devotional service by always thinking of Krishna, always glorifying him, and always chanting about him, we will be reinstated in our original constitutional position and thus be saved. So this is our purpose as devotees of Krishna. This is the process. That as we continue to hear about Krishna, to chant about Krishna, to chant his name, to recite these different pastimes, and then, of course, from hearing and chanting comes remembering. Then we remember that the remembrance of Krishna is there with us. And if we are remembering Krishna, then we are not thinking of Maya. It's very simple. We simply replace material consciousness with spiritual consciousness. Well, at least it sounds simple, right? Except our minds can be very difficult and very tricky. But that's another class. But the principle is there. The more that we're involved in Krishna consciousness, the more the process of hearing and chanting is there, the more that we are remembering Krishna throughout our day and throughout our life, then the less opportunity there is for further engagement and entanglement with the material energy. So it's not that we can artificially stop material thoughts. It's not that we can simply stop our senses, that we can stop our minds. This is the artificial process that yogis or meditators may try to do. We know that this is practically impossible. Even 5,000 years ago, Arjuna said to control the mind is like controlling the restless wind. So we don't try to do that. We take up the process of sadhana bhakti, and we control the mind by hearing and chanting about Krishna, by becoming attracted to his wonderful pastimes. And we have these very, very special days like Janmashtami, which give us special impetus to think about Krishna, to remember Krishna, and to serve Krishna. So we need to take advantage of this process, take advantage of this very, very special day, a day that gives us the opportunity to become more and more immersed in thinking about Krishna and Krishna's pastimes. So I'll end with a final verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is one of Lord Brahma's prayers to Krishna in the 14th chapter after the stealing the coward boys and calves. Lord Brahma says, "In time, learned philosophers or scientists might be able to count all the atoms of the earth, the particles of snow, or perhaps even the shining molecules radiating from the sun, the stars, and other luminaries. But among those learned men, who could possibly count the unlimited transcendental qualities possessed by you, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who have descended onto the surface of the earth for the benefit of all living entities?" Jai. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Bol. Hare Krishna. Thank you. Looks like they're almost ready here. If anyone had a comment or question, we might have a minute here. Yes, please. To hear Krishna's flute.
Yeah, but those who got the Brahman initiation, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sudhakar explained, all of Vrind itself is the source of the flute.
Yes.
That's why it was introduced.
That's true. Yes, the comment was that actually in the sound of the flute is contained within the Gayatri Mantra. So we are experiencing that. But I'm so dull-headed that, you know, I'm not recognizing it very well. Thank you. Good. Yes. Apurva Prabhu.
You mentioned the pastime about Krishna leaving the houses.
Mm-hmm.
Mathura. Yeah. The residents were pressed forward. We also hear that Krishna never leaves Vrindavan.
Yes.
So, I mean, what does that mean? Because if he never leaves Vrindavan, then why is everyone?
Well, both things are true simultaneously in Lord Krishna's inconceivable ways. It's also described that even when the gopis and the other residents of Vrindavan are experiencing separation, that through that separation they actually feel closer to Krishna. So, you know, it's obviously something that's on the transcendental platform that defies material logic, that the more that one feels separation, the more one feels attachment, or the more one feels close to Krishna. And of course, it is described in some of the purports in the Bhagavatam explain how Krishna does not leave Vrindavan, that he's always there, and that the residents of Vrindavan experience him with their spiritual bodies, in their transcendental forms. They're actually experiencing Krishna and are never separated from him. But he externally appears to leave. And to the degree that they are feeling this suffering and anguish, it's actually for the purpose of increasing their love. Krishna is not trying to cause suffering and pain to his devotees, but he's actually increasing their love and by increasing their sense of separation. Because even materially, we can understand that if you really like somebody or you're in love with somebody and they, you know, and they go away, then you feel that separation so much. You know, so we can understand a little bit about how that, you know, they even say absence makes the heart grow fonder. So Krishna will appear to leave and separate to increase that love of his devotees. You know, and that's the extent of my understanding, at least. Right. Yeah, cool. Yeah. Why are that we experience suffering because of forgetfulness of our relationship? Yes, because it's our constitutional position. Our Sanatana Dharma, our nature, is that we are part and parcel of Krishna, that we have a loving relationship with Krishna. So when we're separated from that relationship, you know, we're naturally going to experience unhappiness and distress. We try to artificially recreate that relationship through material relationships. You know, through everything we do in this material world, we try so hard to find that happiness, which is really meant to be our happiness in relationship with God, with Krishna. You know, so it's an artificial imposition. We're artificially trying to accomplish something, you know, some relationship, you know, some enjoyment that really is not possible. Because our real nature is spiritual, therefore it is only in a spiritual relationship with the Supreme Spirit, God, that we can become happy. So it looks like we're a lot happening out here, this side of the room. We should probably end there. Shri Krishna Janmashtami ki jai, Shri Prabhupada ki jai.